This is The Takeaway for Thursday, August 1st. I'm Tanzina Vega. Coal miners in Kentucky are protesting and hoping not to be a casualty in a declining industry.
Coal production is at an all-time low and is projected to continue to keep falling. We had fewer miners working last year than we did in the last year of the Obama administration.
The president has repeatedly vowed to protect coal, but the markets say otherwise. And we examine the widespread violence against African Americans in 1919's Red Summer.
Yeah, that was really one of the defining characteristics of the Red Summer is the determination of African Americans to not submit to this wholesale attack on their lives and their humanity.
Plus, comedian Hannah Gadsby opens up about being on the autism spectrum.
Is that saying you don't see the forest for the trees or you don't see the trees for the forest? I think my experience of the spectrum is I see the forest and the trees.
We're so glad you're with us. Let's get started. Coal miners are protesting in southeastern Kentucky after getting laid off earlier this month and then having their paychecks bounce. It's a symbolic moment in a declining industry that still holds a place of importance in this country's mythology and in politicians' talking points. On July 1st, the West Virginia-based mining company Black Jewel filed for bankruptcy and laid off more than 1,000 workers in its eastern division across Appalachia. Before the bankruptcy, Black Jewel was the sixth largest coal producer in the country. But many workers still haven't received their last paycheck, so on Monday, some miners in Cumberland took matters into their own hands and organized a protest. They set up camp on the train tracks and have been preventing coal trains from getting in and out of the plant near the town. Nathan Brown is the owner of the restaurant John Evan Jack's in Corbin, Kentucky. And on Tuesday, he decided to lend his support.
We have a mobile food truck, and we just took it there. So we fried them up some catfish and cheeseburgers, you know, just to be able to give them a hot meal fresh off the grill and food fresh out of the fryer.
Nathan was able to see firsthand just how these miners have been affected by the bankruptcy.
You know, talking to the families, you know, I talked to one guy, he had multiple kids, and his biggest concern was, you know, school starting back next week. You know, what are we going to do? How am I going to buy supplies and all that stuff? And his little boy running around playing on the train tracks while they're playing cornhole on the train tracks. It was just, that was probably the most powerful image I've ever saw in my life.
So far, the protesters have said they aren't going anywhere until they get paid. But the fate of over 1,000 workers and of this coal company remains unclear. Joining me now are two journalists from the Ohio Valley Resource News Collaboration. Sydney Bowles is a reporter with WMMT in Eastern Kentucky covering economic transition. Sydney, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And we also have Brittany Patterson, energy and environment reporter for West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Great to have you on, Brittany.
Glad to be here.
So, Brittany, let's start with you. Why did Black Jewel suddenly file for bankruptcy?
So on July 1st, the company filed for bankruptcy, and basically they cited adverse market conditions, which is something that we've been hearing from a lot of coal companies in recent years that have filed for bankruptcy. Basically, the company said that, you know, as the demand for coal-fired electricity has dropped, and the prices of renewable energy and natural gas have become less expensive, the economics for coal have been harder to make work.
And so when were the workers last paid, Brittany?
So workers have not received their last paycheck. Those were issued on the Friday in June before the July 1st bankruptcy. For our Eastern employees in Appalachia, the workers were issued paper paychecks, and those have subsequently not been allowed to be cashed. For the Western employees in Wyoming, because we should note this company has mines in both Wyoming and Kentucky, West Virginia, and Virginia. In Wyoming, those workers were issued money orders. There was a snafu with those, but most of those have now been cashed.
And Sydney, you've been reporting from the protests. Give us a sense of what it's looked like over the past few days. What's the mood there among the protesters?
Sure. So this started pretty organically Monday morning with five miners getting up right in front of a coal train to prevent that train from leaving the washing plant. their intention was basically, you know, to keep the coal from leaving the station until they got their paycheck. They have since grown from a group of 5 to sometimes upwards of 100, a rotating cast of miners and supporters from all across the community. And folks have really shown up to bring food, even porta potties, tents, picnic tables, all kinds of snacks. It's really been incredible to watch members from all across the community, all across the political spectrum show up to support these guys. But underneath it all, there's still a real anger and a real commitment to stay on these railroad tracks until they get the money for work that they've already done.
Brittany, during President Trump's campaign and beyond, once he was elected president, he's championed the coal industry.
And you watch what happens. If I win, we're going to bring those miners back. You're going to be so proud of your president. You're going to be so proud of your country.
Clean, beautiful West Virginia coal. We love it.
We are back. The coal industry is back.
Does that track with the overall health of the industry so far?
So President Trump and the Trump administration have really tried to help the coal industry by easing regulations, namely through the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. We've seen rollbacks and replacements of a lot of different coal-related regulations. But the federal data show that coal production is at an all-time low and is projected to continue to keep falling. Similarly, we had fewer miners working last year than we did in the last year of the Obama administration. So in the thermal coal market, that's coal that's used in electric utilities and at power plants, we've definitely seen that continue to drop. Here in West Virginia, we have seen a little uptick in metallurgical coal. That's coal that's mined to make steel. But those upticks have been mostly driven by exports abroad and mostly to China and Asian countries. So largely speaking, no, the regulatory rollbacks that the administration has tried to do have not really helped the industry here in Appalachia.
And Brittany, I'm wondering if that also has influenced just not just this protest alone, but the broader picture of the lives of coal miners in the region since the Trump administration took over. I mean, have their lives gotten better? And is there a sense that, I'm not going to assume that all of these folks voted for the president, but it seemed like an important base for the president. And I'm wondering if that could potentially affect his support among this group in 2020.
It's a little bit of a challenging question to answer. On the one hand, certainly some miners, especially those working in these met coal mines, may have gone back to work over the last few years. On the other hand, you know, all the regulatory rollbacks in the world can't really change the underlying economics that are affecting the coal industry. And that is that natural gas has become very cheap and renewable energy, solar and wind, that continues to fall. And many utility customers continue to ask those utilities to put on renewable energy and cheaper forms of electricity. And that just can't compete with coal. And so I think in some ways you hear a reaction from miners feeling a little bit like there's only so much the president can do. And on the other hand, we haven't seen resources for things like job retraining increase here in the region.
And Sydney, last night in the Democratic debate, Jay Inslee, one of the candidates, echoed what a lot of folks talking about climate change have said, which is that we need to get rid of coal altogether.
We cannot work this out. The time is up. Our house is on fire. We have to stop using coal in 10 years. And we need a president to do it or it won't get done. Get off coal. Save this country and the planet. That's what I'm for.
That is something that would obviously have a severe impact on this community. What do workers in this industry think about that? And do they see any alternatives in when they look at their future?
I will say there's a broad spectrum among miners that I've spoken to, both at this protest and in other places across the region. Some folks really do feel that, you know, going back generations, coal has really been the only industry that has supported this part of the country, that has allowed families and communities here to flourish. And there's a real fear of what might happen when coal is no longer a strong enough economy to drive these communities. But at the same time, I will say there is a growing understanding that there may need to be a diversification of the economy. Many former miners and even some current miners are interested in renewable energy jobs and are thinking about ways to find other forms of work that can build on their skill sets to help create a more diverse economy here.
And if you could expand a little bit on that, I mean, Sydney, I'm wondering what the history of Black Jewel is in the region and also just the culture of mining and coal mining in particular in the region and even across the country. It sort of seems like it's a big part of our cultural mythology in many ways.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the first thing I'll say is that there's a real sense of pride among miners who are working in the coal industry. Many of these folks are third or fourth or fifth generation coal miners, and there's a sense that it runs in their blood. It's hard work. It takes a lot of skill, and miners feel really, really proud of doing this hard work to take care of their families. But over the course of history, mining has also taken a real toll on communities here, both in terms of miners' health through the black lung epidemic and accidents in the mine as well, an environmental toll with, mine runoff and other sorts of challenges with surface mining and underground mining here too. So I think there is an understanding that mining comes with a cost. So over the course of history, miners have banded together to stand up to the companies that they work for and to the government to ask for fair wages, to ask for safer working conditions. Actually, Harlan County, where these protests are taking place, was the site of bloody mine wars back in the 1930s. And actually, the anniversary of the 1973-74 Harlan miner strike was just last week. So there is a long history in this region of miners understanding the cost of the work that they're doing and working hard as a community to try and make working conditions a little better.
Brittany, have Appalachian states been able to attract other industries? And we talked a little bit about this earlier, but I'd love to drill down a little bit more, like renewable energy and beyond that might be able to replace some of the losses here in terms of the coal industry.
Yeah, I would say, largely speaking, our policymakers have not got on board with putting policies in place that would make renewable energy a really viable and vibrant option here in Appalachia. For example, both West Virginia and Kentucky do not have renewable portfolio standards. Those are basically standards that set a target for how much renewable energy utilities should produce. Similarly, while Ohio has an renewable portfolio standard, a bill passed last month really guts it. And so we see here that not necessarily our policymakers have put into place the policies that would bring in renewable energy and make it easy for large companies to attract. And I think that's important because if you want an Amazon, even an Amazon sort of packing center or any of these big companies, they all have renewable energy mandates. And if they can't get that energy, then it makes it a harder sell to get them to come here.
And I'm curious, Brittany, what has Black Jewel said about the protesters? Have they responded?
We haven't seen a lot of direct response to the protesters. I will say during the entire bankruptcy proceedings that have occurred over the last month, the lawyers representing the company have expressed their sympathies and have sort of repeatedly said that they understand that miners are hurting. Similarly, the judge in the case has also really expressed a lot of concern about this. But at this point, you know, the company says it doesn't have the money to pay these owed wages. And we're talking about nearly $11.8 million in payroll and taxes. Then that's just owed to employees in Kentucky, Virginia, and West Virginia. So it's a pretty significant amount of money that the company would need to come up with. And at this point, considering the chaos that has been this bankruptcy, the company says they just can't make that happen right now.
Sydney, when you hear that and you are on the ground talking to protesters and folks who have not been paid, what's your sense of where this goes next, for them at least?
Well, the goal at this point is for Black Jewel to use money from sales of mines, which is actually scheduled to happen today, to pay these miners' wages that they're owed. That may or may not happen. That's kind of the plan at this point. So that may determine what happens next with this protest. But no matter what time of day I talk to miners who are camped out on these tracks, no matter what mood they're in, the sentiment is the same. They're not moving until they get paid.
Sydney Bowles is a reporter for Ohio Valley Resource and WMMT in Eastern Kentucky. And Brittany Patterson is energy and environment reporter for West Virginia Public Broadcasting and the Ohio Valley Resource. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This year marks 100 years since what came to be known as Red Summer, a series of violent attacks and riots against African Americans across the country over many months in 1919.
The term Red Summer was coined by James Weldon Johnson, who at the time was field secretary for the NAACP. And he used the term Red Summer to signify the blood that flowed during those months.
Chad Williams is chair of African American Studies at Brandeis University.
It was a period of really truly unprecedented racial violence, one of the worst periods of racial violence in American history, where you have nearly three dozen riots, massacres taking place throughout the country, literally in every corner of the nation.
The wave of Black activism that met this violence bolstered organizations like the NAACP and helped lay the groundwork for current movements like Black Lives Matter. But Chad Williams told me why the end of World War I created the conditions that led to that violent period.
You have the United States just having fought and won a war ostensibly to make the world safe for democracy. But by the spring of 1919, the euphoria of winning the war had worn off, and it was replaced with tremendous anxiety about what was going to happen, to the United States in terms of labor relations, in terms of race relations. And that really coalesces into these very local but incredibly spectacular forms of racial violence that we see happening across the country. And Black veterans are at the heart of that conflict.
Now, you say anxiety. This was anxiety that white Americans were feeling towards Black Americans?
Certainly. And you see this manifesting in different ways in both the North and the South. And it plays out in terms of labor relations. There's tremendous tension surrounding the shortage of jobs. Again, you have American soldiers, literally tens of thousands, returning back to the United States on a daily basis, returning back to their homes, some not returning to their homes, relocating to other areas, largely in the North. So there's a tremendous strain just on labor, job opportunities, and the competition that ensues. So there's anxieties surrounding that. There's anxieties surrounding the so-called return to normalcy, this desire on the part of many Americans to try and return to a pre-war status quo. And that coming into conflict with the expectations, particularly amongst African-Americans and Black veterans in particular, that they were not going to return to a state of normalcy, that things were going to be different. They had just fought a war to make the world safe for democracy. They had contributed their labor, their lives to the American war effort, and they expected to be treated as not just equal citizens, but full human beings, right? And those expectations really went counter to the desire for many white Americans to reinstill a sense of normalcy in the form of white supremacy.
Chad, how much of this violence was either ignored by the state, local or federal law enforcement, or sanctioned, if you will, by those entities?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, that African Americans could not expect protection from the state. Right. And that's something that we're obviously still grappling with today in many different forms. At the federal level, when we think about the role that Woodrow Wilson played or didn't play in the violence of the Red Summer, he essentially turned a blind eye to what was happening. So literally during the Washington, D.C. riot, as African-Americans are being beaten and killed directly across the street from the White House, he's doing nothing. In terms of federal troops, sometimes they help to quell the violence. But in cases like in Arkansas, they were active participants and contributed to the violence. And the same could be said for local police as well. So on the one hand, there's this kind of larger national story of the state really turning its back on protecting a group of American citizens, form of African Americans. But then when we kind of drill down at the local level, we see how those local dynamics really play out in different ways. Thinking about the differences between a place like Arizona and Arkansas, for example, and Chicago, where you do have police who are sometimes participating in the riots, but then the National Guard steps in and they really help kind of quell the violence and keep the peace. So the local dynamics, I think, are really important to consider as well.
We know that Black Americans have not gone quietly in a lot of these instances. There has been a history of resistance in the African American and Black American communities. Tell us what it looked like during Red Summer.
Yeah, that was really one of the defining characteristics of the Red Summer, is the determination of African Americans to not submit to this wholesale attack on their lives and their humanity, to engage in active, conscious, collective resistance, self-defense. We see this manifesting in a number of different places in a number of different ways, certainly physical self-defense. During the Washington, D.C. riot, during the Chicago riot, you have Black veterans who are taking up arms, who are setting up defensive positions and taking out white people in the process. But you also have collective resistance in the form of civil rights organizations like the NAACP, who really comes into its own as a national organization, in large part due to the efforts of James Weldon Johnson during World War I and in the aftermath of World War I. So they use the Red Summer as an opportunity to demonstrate its commitment to protecting African Americans and their civil rights.
We are nearing the anniversary of Ferguson and the events that happened there a couple of years ago. Many would argue that that was the beginning, if not what spurred, or around the beginning of the time of Black Lives Matter and that wave of Black resistance. Red Summer also marked a new era of Black resistance, particularly to white violence. How do you connect, or can we connect, the Black resistance then to where it is today?
Certainly. Well, one of the most iconic, legendary poems coming out of the summer of 1919 was by Claude McKay, If We Must Die. And, you know, he said, if we must die, let it not be like hogs slaughtered. We're going to fight back. And we see that legacy, that spirit of resistance, of collective determination to resist white racial violence, whether it's in the form of individual vigilante violence, whether it's in the form of state violence, continuing throughout the 20th century, and I think manifesting itself in the form of the Black Lives Matter movement that is still certainly active today.
Chad Williams is professor and chair of African American Studies at Brandeis University and the author of Torchbearers of Democracy, African American Soldiers in the World War I Era. Chad, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Last summer, comedian Hannah Gadsby reached a global audience when her special Nanette premiered on Netflix. Nanette didn't just resonate with viewers because it was funny, although it was very funny. The special was also deeply personal and found Hannah wrestling with trauma, rage, and even the conventions of comedy itself.
I do think I have to quit comedy, though. And seriously, and it's probably not the forum to make such an announcement, is it? in the middle of a comedy show, but I have been questioning, you know, this whole comedy thing. I don't feel very comfortable in it anymore.
1 year later, Hannah is back on stage performing in a new show called Douglas. But she told me that doesn't mean she isn't quitting, in a sense.
In a sense, I have quit what I was doing. My life has changed. But also, it was a theatrical conceit. I understood the criticisms that were going to come and I cut them off at the path. I said, yes, I know you're going to call this not comedy. How about I quit before you call it not comedy?
In many ways, Douglas picks up where Nanette left off, with Hannah going far beyond the normal confines of a comedy show.
Being able to speak in front of a live audience is an incredible opportunity, and I don't think it should be restricted to, you know, either theatre situation or comedy situation. I think there's something to be said about being able to stand up as an individual and talk to a group of people.
One thing Hannah talks to audiences about in her new show is being diagnosed with autism. And she told me that her diagnosis is a part of the show's very DNA.
The central premise behind the show is that, you know, those bits that come later in the show that are divulging the diagnosis and, you know, how the world sees me and how that affects me. But the entire show is about autism, and the framework is an autistic mind. Everything that I do in the show, before I even talk about autism, is autism. It is autistic in tone, and that is incredibly important for me that people not necessarily understand to put words to. I don't know that culturally we are aware enough of how to talk about the autism experience, but I want people to experience it. And I think I'm getting it across.
It's fascinating, because I was going to ask you whether that was part of, at the beginning of the show, you spell out for the audience what's going to happen. And was that part of that experience also, wanting people to understand the autistic mind?
To a certain extent, but also this show is for people on the spectrum. So that's for people on the spectrum. People not on the spectrum will enjoy it and go, oh, that's cheeky. But the show is loaded. It is so loaded. It feels like it's just skipping across, but you could watch it 3 or 4 times and still pick stuff up. That's the fun for it. It's a puzzle. I have written it for myself and people on my side of the spectrum in mind to say, oh, there's pieces of puzzles to pick up. I've been listening to the same audiobook for the last 2 years. Right? That's, you know, surprises aren't what I'm in. That's not my bag. So this show is sort of like, oh, there are no surprises, but there's a journey. And if you walk the same path every day, you see every day's a new day with an autistic mind. You know, there's that saying, you don't see the forest for the trees, or you don't see the trees for the forest. I think my experience of the spectrum is I see the forest and the trees. So it's a busy mind. It's like, yep, there's a forest. There's also trees. There's lots of trees. Did you see the forest? And that's what I'm trying to do with the show.
And yet people are laughing. You spelled it all out. There were still moments of surprise in the show, even though you laid it out for us. So let's talk a little bit about some of the elements in the show, at least thematically, that were interesting to me. I want to talk about anger, talk about rage, and how it played in Nanette. It was a big part of Nanette. It was something that inspired us here at The Takeaway to examine the role of rage in particular and women. And at some point you said you didn't think anger could be productive. And what I took away in Douglas, and tell me if I'm wrong, is that it feels like you found ways to channel that anger into something that there was a phrase you used called reasonable rage. Tell me about that.
I think reasonable rage is that, you know, is to find a reasonable way to express frustration. And I don't explore that necessarily in Douglas. I'm not exploring the reasonable rage. I feel like Nanette was my reasonable rage. Nanette was as much about autism as Douglas, but I didn't say it expressly. But also Nanette was a lot to do with trauma. And I think we don't allow people who are traumatized the room to be angry. And I think you need to be angry and you need to be heard. And that was the incredible thing about the journey of Nanette, is I didn't expect my anger to be received very well. I fully expected it to be rejected. But I can't claim I authored that experience completely. I put the work out there, but it was also in the zeitgeist, something, 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 something. With Douglas, I'm playing. All my anger in Douglas is mock anger. It is playful, although I have received feedback that people think it's just anger, which makes me laugh so much. I'm dead inside. It's not like the anger in Nanette was real and visceral, and because it was tied up in my own trauma, I wasn't removed from it. Like my performance in Nanette, there was genuine pain every time I performed it, because you don't get to just partition yourself off from your trauma when you face it full on like I did. And also I couldn't ignore the room. Every time I put that in a room, I felt, you know, there's a misunderstanding about autism that we don't have empathy. I think if there's a lack of empathy, it is because we have to lock ourselves off from it, because we're basically, we don't have skin. Well, my experience of it and a lot of people's experience of it, it is a spectrum. So in a room full of people who I've put in shock, I feel that. That affects me, and that what you can see in my performance of it. And so they're very, very different beasts in that sense, in how I so talk and express anger. So in Douglas, when I say, you know, anger is, I have reasonable anger, that's Nanette. That was all reasonable. I had every right. But with Douglas, it is all just play, and it's fun.
Oh, it's very fun. One of the things that was fun was also how you have a theme throughout which focuses on language. As a journalist, I'm very interested in the language and the words. And you say that men, particularly white men, have named all of the things, right? And when you think about it, it's so true. Why was that something you wanted to talk about now? Why was language and cultural imperialism and male dominance of language something that you thought needed to be a part of this?
Well, I think after Nanette, I wanted to do another piece of work because I knew the world was watching, and I felt to me that I either had to disappear and be good for my word, but I don't know what else to do. And also I wanted to stick within my skill set. You know, I didn't want to go, oh, I'll make a TV show now because someone said I could. And I'm like, I don't know how to do that. So I thought I would do the next thing with all my tools that I know how to use. So that's the decision behind it. And the name thing is quite, language itself is a distancing tool. You know, in Nanette, I was just there. I was just really ripped myself open. I felt so vulnerable and I still feel vulnerable. Like the world's carried me away. I'm not in control of my own life. And that
post-Nanette.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, like not necessarily in a bad way. I've got lots of opportunities, but change is not a great, easy thing for me to navigate. And my life is moving a lot faster than I really not understand how to navigate. But that is all fine. With it comes a lot of privilege and opportunity. But language for me then is a way of distancing myself and playing with that as a remove. But also language does shape culture. And those who get to choose the language get to choose how to shape culture. We know that. And we can see it in effect. This, you know, social media is, you know, the way we hate speech is a lot freer on social media now. Like that is the way it is. People are feeling more brave about not being more caring. And so that has been a fascinating thing for me. And I did get a lot of hate after Nanette. And a lot of that hate, it was disguised as critical feedback, but the language was hateful. And people who engage with Nanette in a critical way that didn't use hateful language is fine. I'm really fine. I don't think I'm everyone's cup of tea, and nor should I be. Everything's okay. For me, what was interesting is when people were wrapping it up in hate, and my mind then goes, why? And not because I'm a historian, a hindsight specialist, so to speak. You know, I'm going, well, what are the roots of these things? And that took me on the path of language, and that's wrapped up also in the way that people frame autism. A lot of that, you know, sometimes we can be really blunt because we don't use metaphor. You know, we're just like, this is a thing, I think. And I like it. I enjoy when other people, you know, dance around what they want to say. That's rich, but that's not how I communicate. And so every word is weighted for me because I don't waste time.
Are we in a moment now where talking about autism and being open about that is more acceptable, or do you think it's just necessary? I mean, how did you make the decision to say, I'm ready to talk about this now?
I made that decision knowing that it was a huge risk. People don't get to talk about autism and create work that is autistic. That's important. Like, I'm not just going, hey, I'm autistic. Here's me talking about autism in a way that is, the whole tone of what I do is autistic. We don't get to speak for ourselves that much. It's often, oh, here's what it looks like from the outside in. I'm trying to do it the other way around. That comes with a huge amount of pressure. A, I can't speak for everyone on the spectrum because it's a spectrum. But also, personally, I come up more and more scrutiny. Does she even have it? Does it mean anything? Is that important? Can women even have autism? You know, because it is so entirely gendered, and that's why I talk a little bit about biology in the show, you know, because it's like it's wrapped up in that. It's wrapped up in the misogyny of medicine, you know. So there's a lot, you know, that I don't sort of necessarily have time or the scope to attack deeply in this show, but it is a risk.
In your work, you also, in this show in particular, in Douglas, you talk a lot about not just the male dominance of language, but the male dominance of comedy and the rules of comedy and how they've been shaped by men. And I think even today when I scroll through, you know, looking for stand-up comedy, I love it. The majority of the options that I see are men, and it's usually a very similar type of comedy. You, on the other hand, are creating almost a new genre that combines all of these things. And in this latest performance with Douglas, it was even visual. As we move forward with this craft, the work that you're doing, are you expectant that there will be more people breaking the traditional male comedy rules?
I hope. That's what I want. The rule, like, I love rules. That's the irony of it. I love rules. And I make up my own rules for comedy. You know, when I set out to write Douglas, I set my own rules. They were arbitrary and sometimes I had to shift them. But I really like rules. But I think with something, especially with expression, you have to work out what rules work for you and your story. My story doesn't fit into set up punchline. And also being autistic, I do not do well in competitive arenas. So doing stand-up in clubs was really painful for me in my early days. Like it was really traumatic, not in that like, oh, I'm a snowflake, because actually, yes, I am a snowflake. I don't like the competitive, combative, you know, gladiatorial culture that surrounds it. I'm not saying that's wrong, but for someone on the spectrum, that is incredibly distressing. So what I'm hoping is I'm like going, oh, we can give it a nudge out into this other place where other people can play with their own forms of expression. I think it is actually a very patriarchal idea, and you see it a lot in the history of modern art. It's like, oh, one voice cancels out the other, and it's like, oh, come on, guys. Come on, let's not play Jenga.
Historical cultural Jenga.
Yeah, right. Like, my voice is not counseling out anybody else's. That is, I can't express that enough. I hope that it's poking a hole in people's expectations. I don't want other people to do shows like mine. As someone on the spectrum, I don't understand other people. I rely on other people to tell me what their life is like. And so that is why I'm so angry at history, because all I've got is Eurocentric white male. So that's all I've got to go on. And I'm like, no, I'm poorer for it. Ironically, I think a lot like a straight white man. But that's not enough. Like, we're poor for this dearth of voices. And so I hope that this means that people can play a lot more.
Do you think it'll resonate, or has it been resonating outside of the U.S. and Australia? Because I know the U.S. was a surprise for you, but going beyond this sort of Eurocentric, you know, white-dominated society.
I'm delighted to say that I have a lovely, huge audience in India and in South America. This pleases me greatly. I don't know what it's like to be from those places, so I'm delighted that there's something about my experience that speaks to people from there. I'd be just delighted to see that perhaps I light a fire under some voices that get to spread in places like that. So I think that's something to say about, you know, I love live performance, but Netflix opened my work up to places that I would not have been able to do on my own steam.
Hannah Gadsby is performing her new show, Douglas, at the Darryl Roth Theater in New York through September 7th. Hannah, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
And that's all for us today. Amy Walter is in tomorrow, and I'll be back on Monday. And the people who make The Takeaway include Lee Hill, Alexandra Botee, Isabel Angel, Ethan Oberman, Rob Gunther, Polly Arungu, Jason Tureski, David Gable, Jivika Vurma, Danny Lewis, Andres O'Hara, Meg Dalton, and Josh Christensen. Our tech team includes Vince Fairchild, Claire McKean, and Jake Howitt. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.